Unless you have been a soldier, you just won't understand the things that we have seen and done in the service of our land. We have trained to live in combat, to cope with awful sights that shouldn't be seen by anyone and keep you awake at nights. We won't discuss the wounds we have to the body or the mind. We just put our hurts behind us and turn our memories to blind. We are proud we have served our country and remember those we lost. For the freedom that you have today, they paid the awful cost. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Going into my fifth year as the host of American Warrior Radio, I never cease to be amazed at the amount of fun I'm having and the distinct pleasure and honor it is to share the stories of the men and women who protect us on the home front and abroad. American Warrior Radio is fortunate in that there's never been a shortage of stories to be told, messages that need to be shared. Some are referred to us through national public relations agencies, movie studios, or book publicists. Some come from you, our listeners. I recently came across the Bravo 748 Military and Combat Speakers Bureau. You can find them at bravo748.com. I encourage you to check them out. I reached out to Jamie to see if any of her speakers might be interested. Several have replied, and we look forward to sharing their stories with you in the weeks to come. The first warrior who replied is our guest on today's show. I liked him initially because he spent some time here in my hometown, and his job, well, one could argue it's the most important job in the military, and frankly, it's never one that even crossed my mind. I pride myself on show prep. If a guest has written a book, I read it before they appear on the show. Yesterday evening, I finished Justin Jordan's book, and then I cried, The Stories of a Mortuary NCO. It has hung with me. The images, the messages have suspended in my mind like a wet wool blanket that I just can't shrug off. You see, even though he was deployed numerous times, Justin never went outside the wire, but nonetheless, death was always on his shoulder, or perhaps more importantly, staring him in the face. There are some shows, ladies and gentlemen, that I know have to be told, but frankly, I'm a little afraid to tell them. So, Justin, I hope you'll lift me up on this, and welcome to American Warrior Radio, Justin Jordan.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. The pleasure is mine to be here today. I really appreciate you having me on.
Ladies and gentlemen, stick around. You need to hear this. Justin, a little bit about you. As a young man, you just really wanted to get out of a small town like many people that joined the military, Henderson, Kentucky. So you enlisted in the Air Force. You served 20 years in a variety of roles, but it was your 6 years as a mortuary NCO that left an indelible mark on, I guess, on your soul, and that's the story we'll be sharing today. Tell us, when you first joined the Air Force, Justin, you wanted to go into the recreational field, but soon you were transformed, in your words, to a war-hardened cooking machine.
That's right. So in the Air Force, the job that I speak about in the book was the mortuary NCO, where, it had a profound effect on my mental well-being. But, you know, in the Air Force, the mortuary NCOs or mortuary officers come from the career fields called services. And they're kind of a jack of all trades, everything from your cooks to working in the hotels, motel management side to recreation. I even worked in a bar at one deployment. So I had a numerous variety of different jobs. But that one unspoken job that no one really talked about was the mortuary services. And I did that in Tucson, Arizona for the 6 years I was stationed there at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base.
Well, and you know, it's important for our civilian listeners out there, if they've never been on a military base, and some, not all of them, but in some cases, that is a just like a little city all unto itself. You've got your shopping, you've got your recreation, you've got your housing. Everything is there on base, so clearly folks need to take care of that business and sustain it, right? And that was kind of really sort of your role.
Yes, sir. While at Davis-Monthan, my primary job was the unit deployment manager, but I was also assigned as the mortuary NCO. And those years I did it, we had quite a few there in Tucson and the deployed locations I went to. So, but yes, for sure, we did a variety of different jobs, fitness centers. There was a huge dining facility there that fed the troops. You have, you name it, in recreation, child care, everything that's morale, welfare, and recreation we took care of.
Now, Justin, one of the phrases that kind of made me chuckle a little bit early in your book, and then I cried, was the phrase, the needs of the Air Force. And that was something that came back to bedevil you several times over your career. But explain to our listeners how you first got involved as a mortuary technician.
Well, I had been stationed at Lackland Air Force Base early in my career. It was my second duty station, and transferred into a special duty assignment at Tyndall Air Force Base, where I was a combat readiness instructor. My job there was to teach all aspects of our career field to the men and women that were about to deploy in our career field, you know, different facets, whether it be forced bed down, which was, you know, bringing up the tents and things that men and women are going to stay in, how we do that, how we manage the lodging population, feeding the troops over there, and then, you know, doing search and recoveries if a plane goes down, you know, picking up human remains, gathering things from the battlefield when we had a man or women fall, you know, at the casualty collection point, and then getting them very quickly in a dignified manner back to Dover Air Force Base from those points. So we taught all of that at that particular site called Red Horse, which is in Tyndall Air Force Base. And then when I moved to Davis-Monthan after that assignment, because I had that experience, it was an easy pick for my commanders to put me in that role, someone that had some experience in that.
Now, are you talking about Red Horse, the engineering group?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I love them. Awesome. I love those guys. That's we've done a couple of shows on Red Horse, and that's very cool. Now, I think one of the reasons I was fascinated by this, particularly in getting into your book, Justin, was this is, and I wasn't kidding when I did this in the intro, this is perhaps the most important job, assuring that our warriors are treated with dignity and respect on their final journey, if you will. And that fell 100% into your hands.
It did. And, you know, I tried to treat every person that I processed like they were my brother or my sister. That weighed heavily on me. Whether I'm dealing with the families or actually handling the remains themselves, I looked at them as family, and I wanted to treat them in a way that I would want my brother, my blood brother, to be treated if that happened to him.
Well, I tell you, one of the quotes that really struck me, Justin, was you said, I had information normal mortals did not want. Boy, I tell you what, after reading your book, BBG wants to be cremated, period. I mean, I just got married, and we're going through, okay, how do you want to do this? And after reading your book, there's no question. I want to be cremated. That's the end of that discussion. But real quick, before our first break, there's things that I never thought of that our listeners need to hear. Very often when you would first get the remains, they would have personal effects with them. And you tell a story about an airman, well, I don't know if it was an airman or not, but someone wearing a watch. And the simple but important things like going in there and cleaning blood off this person's watch or their wallet.
Well, when it becomes personal is when it, you know, it hurts your soul. When you can reflect back on some of the things that you own, whether it be a watch. I've had to take phones apart to clean blood out of them before, you know, because I never wanted the family to have that stark reminder. They've been through enough. So I took very, you know, a lot of care to make sure that any time I had a personal effects that I had to deliver to a family, that it was, you know, thoroughly cleaned and that there were no stark reminders of what had happened.
And in the book, you go in, we'll talk a little bit later about the leathers and the camera. But I tell you that, Justin, that really touched me because, again, particularly as a civilian, a lot of us don't think about this, but if we do think about it, then we realize this is a messy business that you and your fellow warriors are in, and sometimes things aren't pristine when their remains come into the morgue.
Yes, sir. And I can remember one case in particular. I was cleaning a phone. It happened to be a friend of mine. Actually, I was cleaning the phone. And while I was cleaning it, his mother called. And, you know, I sat there and looked at that number, and she had not been notified yet. So I can't answer that phone.
Yeah.
But I can remember it like it was yesterday. It seemed like the longest, loudest ringtone I've ever heard in my life. It just drug on. And I knew that the next time that she spoke on that phone, that she was going to get the worst news that she ever got in her life. I just wasn't the one that could deliver it to her. But it hurt my soul in a way that, you know, it's unrepairable.
Well, and you were cleaning that phone, as you mentioned, these were family friends of yours at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, and the spouse, the wife, had told you that in order to notify family, he had those contacts on his phone, so you had to recover the phone and clean it up in order to make that notification, or for someone to make those notifications.
Yes.
Wow.
And, it was something, like I said, it left a mark on my soul that it's unrepairable, but, you know, with time, all wounds heal.
Ladies and gentlemen, the book is And Then I Cried, Stories of a Mortuary NCO. Our guest is Justin Jordan. Very, very powerful stuff. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. You need to hear this. Stick around, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Justin Jordan. He's the author of a book called And Then I Cried, Stories of a Mortuary NCO. He came to us from the Bravo 748 Speakers Bureau. Lots of great folks. You'll be hearing more coming up. I encourage you to visit their website, bravo748.com. Justin, back to you. A couple other things I just want to get out of the way. And I tell you what, I sent you an email before the show telling you your book was a tough read. I didn't mean that in a bad way. I mean, literally, I'm sitting there reading your book and I'm crying. I mean, I'm weeping at my desk. But some of the things that we don't think about that I found very enlightening from your book, you talked about, for example, when some of the remains come back in the caskets, they have to be scanned by a bomb scanner.
Sir. When they come back from a you know, what we call the AOR, the area of responsibility in a war zone, when they go through Dover, they have to go through a metal detector and a 3D scanner to make sure that there's no unexploded ordnance, or like we call them in the military, UXOs. Mm-hmm. And that's just to ensure the safety of everyone in the treatment team, because, you know, something might have been missed overseas, so they want to just take time to do that and make sure that there's nothing in the remains that may cause harm to others.
You know, something else I found very touching, you talked about when you go to remove the remains from an aircraft or in other ways transfer them, you and your fellow technicians were very cautious to use covert routes. And the reason for that was it's bad enough being a warrior and particularly being in a combat zone, but just sort of the morale and the strain of seeing those remains being transferred is something that you worked very hard to keep out of the average airman's field of view.
Yes, absolutely. We worked very hard to, you know, plan our routes ahead of time if we had time, but we wanted to avoid the base population because, you know what you're doing over there, and you know that there is an expectation that you may not come home. To have a constant reminder of that with the men and women that didn't make it home can, you know, not only affect the morale, but it can affect the psyche. So we wanted to make sure that we treated that in a way that, you know, that kept our business behind the curtain, so to speak.
Now, Justin, again, to remind, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was, I don't want to say a part-time job for you, but you weren't just sitting around waiting for this to happen. You had other duties, but on occasion, that pager or that cell phone would ring, and you knew it was time to go to work.
Yes, sir. I was one deployment I did. I was fitness management, sports management, other deployments. I worked in the food warehouse, make sure that everybody had, you know, subsistence while they're over there. And when that phone rang, then that became my primary duty. At Davis Maffin, my primary duties was unit deployment manager. So my job was to manage all of the deployments going in and out, making sure all the troops got to where they needed, everything from training all the way up. But when that phone rang, I would hand that duty off to someone else, and mortuary became my primary focus.
Justin, I hope most of our listeners haven't had to experience this. I have. You certainly have. There are some things in your book, you know, you talk about there's some things you can't unsee. There's some things you can't unsmell. the smell of death is one of those things that I found that it's, I don't know if it's psychological, but it's almost like it sticks in your nostrils even after the source is gone. It just sort of hangs with you. And I tell you, one of the things that really frightened me, I guess, in a way, when you talked about you're a little ways into this part of your career field, and it became so bad that when you would meet people and shake their hands, you avoided looking into their eyes because you would always get this vision of them on that table or them on that slab in the mortuary. Tell our listeners a little more about that.
Well, when the first time I ever saw a remains on the table, the thing that stuck out to me the most was the eyes. They call them dead eyes. There's a lack of any liquid. So when you look at someone's eyes, we just subconsciously, you can see the sheen in their eyes, the reflection. It's gone. They're gray, and the color is out of them, and they look dead. And when, you know, and you can see their expressions on their faces, and most times it was a fear. And that really stuck with me. And when I would look at meet someone new, I troubled making eye contact for fear of seeing that in someone alive. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me now, but it did at the time. And, you know, it would do this, especially in my family. Mm-hmm. And I could automatically, when I would look someone in the eyes, see them on the table. And that was even with my daughter. And that was something that was really troubling to me.
I mentioned before, Justin, I took a little bit of license. I hope it's okay about, you know, death being on your shoulder constantly, or even looking in your eyes. And literally, even it's almost like you couldn't get away from it. Literally, something is, I don't want to say as simple, but someone stealing pork, a little pork. Well, let's say a lot of pork, $1.5 million of pork. Number one, I don't get how people are stealing pork in a Muslim country, but that was somewhat odd. That was part of your other duties. Share that story with our listeners, if you would.
Yeah, I was working in the food warehouse there, and we had one of the largest ones in the area of responsibility. And, I noticed some of the third country nationals taking forklifts out to the dumpsters, and it was odd because it's just not something they did. They weren't allowed to drive them, and then, you know, why would they be taking trash out on the forklift? It's not that heavy. So I did some investigation. I found out that they were flash freezing pork products, double wrapping them in trash bags and putting them in one specified dumpster. And then they had a deal with the local trash company, and they would sell that on the black market downtown, mostly to expatriates. They'd been doing this for quite a while. And, you know, I think the grand tally had come up to $1.5 million over the years they've been doing it. No one really caught them. And, you know, that it was like, wow, how could they do, like you said, in a Muslim country, you wouldn't think. A lot of times we don't think that these things are going on, but it was going on. And it just, you know, it was something that I look back on and I'm not ashamed of doing, because I know it's the right thing. But, you know, I believe from all that I've been told, those men were executed for their role in that. And I kind of felt guilty about, you know, should I just turn the other cheek? But I know I shouldn't have, because I was, you know, my job in the Air Force, our core values are integrity first, mm-hmm. service before self, and excellence in all we do. So I knew it was the right thing to do, but I was conflicted by it because of, you know, from what I understand, they lost their lives because of it.
Well, and I'll tell you, Justin, not everything in the book is bad, but I tell you, there were some moments I would guess that I gleaned where it was a reward, what little rewards you had in that line of work. There was one young lady who you were handling the remains of her husband. She had been prior military, and it was kind of a rough patch there. And she actually told you, I had given up on the Air Force until I met you.
This young lady was pretty bitter at the Air Force. She was medically retired for a back injury, as I remember it, and didn't want to deal with any of the officers. She would only deal with me. She wanted her husband, died of a heart attack, to be buried in his battle dress uniform, which was, you know, the camo uniform, which was odd. Normally it's dress blues, but she, you know, she dealt with me, and he was actually cremated, as I remember it, but she wanted him cremated in that because he felt most comfortable being a maintainer in that uniform. And she was just bitter to deal with from all the officers and, you know, anybody. But, you know, for some reason she took a liking to me, and I took extra care to make sure that her husband's remains were remains were treated with dignity and respect. And the day of the memorial, I can remember it was a grand event in the hangar, and they, you know, they played bagpipes and taps, and, you know, as I'm meeting her in the back to deliver the cremated remains to her, she stopped me and she said, I'd given up on the Air Force until I met you. And that really, you know, kind of left me with a welling of pride, but mixed emotions, not knowing whether, because I never really tried to let my emotions come into play when I did my job, because if not, I'd be crying all the time. Sometimes it was unavoidable. I would sit in my car on the way home. I lived out in Vail, Arizona, out in the Del Lago area. And I would drive in 30 minutes, and sometimes I just needed to release it, and I would cry.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things I've seen, but I can remember that being a high point in the career, that, you know, she appreciated all the work I did, and it made a difference on her.
Well, when we come back, I want to talk about another high point that really stood out to me in your book. But, you know, my sense, Justin, is, like I said, that was, I see that as one of the most important jobs in the military, and you took great pride in doing that and making sure each and every family member of these fallen wars was taken care of and things were done correctly. There's things that, you know, some folks just don't need to know or don't need to see in due respect. And, but I got a sense, sir, that, you know, sometimes for every one of those families that you took care of, a little piece of you kind of was taken away and went out the door. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live on the phone by Justin Jordan. His book is And Then I Cried, Stories of a Mortuary NCO. We're going to talk a little bit more about his job, but more importantly, how it affected Justin and how he came back from that. Stick around. You're going to want to hear this. Find us, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. We'll be right back.
The fight till it was done. You have the strength to carry on. You thought it'd be much better back home, did ya? You try each day, keep pushing through, but the battle lives inside of you. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Special shout out to that amazing rendition of Hallelujah. That's Sailor Jerry. You can find more at sailorjerrymusic.com. We're joined by Justin Jordan. Justin had a 20-year career in the Air Force, 6 years of which, if I'm not mistaken, Justin, you were a mortuary NCO. And I tell you, the reason I really wanted you on the show was that as a civilian, this is something I never thought about. You think about it half a second, you realize, oh, yes, the war is a messy business. This kind of work has to be done. Justin, one of the things that really struck me, I enjoyed about the book, you had volunteered to escort, and I don't know what the proper term is for that, where you actually escort the remains of the fallen warrior back to their family. Is there a name, a special name for that?
No, military escort. That's the proper name for
okay.
It. Yes.
So you were volunteered to serve as a military escort for some remains that are going from Tucson back to L.A., and there was a real poignant moment you describe in the book where they're offloading the remains, I think it was at LAX, and you look up in the terminal, and here's all these people lining the windows looking down, and there was a little boy holding his father's hand, and he gave you a salute. And I think you said you've never been prouder to return a salute. Does that stick with you? Is that one of those moments where it's like, you know what, this is worth it. I'm doing a good thing.
It did. You know, we entered into LAX, and the pilot who was, I found out when I entered the plane, he was a former A-10 pilot. And those of you that I know are familiar with DM, that is the aircraft that is at DM, Davis Monthan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he actually walked me back to my seat, but when he came on the thing, he said, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to, don't be alarmed, we're going to hit the plane with water cannons, as a show of respect, because we have an airman that is on the last ride home ever. And he asked, you know, when I got down to the tarmac to, you know, lower the remains, the honor guard was there from the airport, and we had a lot of support. And I looked back kind of over my shoulder, and I saw that little boy up in the kind of, you know, it's kind of a glass archway up there. And it really stuck with me. It really did. And, you know, there are moments in this job that I look back and I kind of smile, and that's one of them.
Well, now, Justin, do you, I had heard another guest share one of the pilots that flew an Angel Flight aircraft. He kept a log every time he transported a fallen warrior, and he kept a log of their names. And when it got to 100, he just stopped. He couldn't do it anymore. Do you have a sense of how many warriors you helped along the way there in their final days over the course of your career?
I stopped counting, but and you know, both deployed in Davis-Monthan in the hundreds for sure.
Okay. Well, I tell you one thing. I just got married, and I appreciate the fact you and your wife had and hopefully continue to have a very open relationship. You discussed everything with each other, but you made a decision not to share some of your experiences, and you said your marriage died a little bit each day because you're choosing to carry the burden by yourself. Tell us about that first time when and for our listeners who don't know Arizona geography, it's about 100 miles from Tucson to Phoenix, and one day Justin Jordan looks up from his steering wheel and you're seeing Phoenix street signs when you thought you were in Tucson.
Yeah, what had happened to me is I started suffering dissociations. The memories and the stack trauma were so much that they would flood into my, you know, people say the intrusive memories. I would have so many of them at once I couldn't complete a thought, and I thought I was going crazy. And, you know, just trying to mentally manage that, I would end up hundreds of miles away from my home and not know how I got there. Much like if you've ever driven home from work or a particularly hard day and you pull in your driveway and you have no recollection, you're like, wow, my body just kind of went on autopilot. That's kind of what it felt like. But there was a lot of fear associated with it because now I'm somewhere I don't recognize where I'm at and what's really going on. And because I'd seen so much death, my brain automatically jumped to the worst case scenario. I must be having a brain tumor. This is it. This is the last time I'm going to, you know. So I learned through therapy and through treatment and help for my PTSD that it was a dissociation and that, you know, I actually got a service dog to help with that along the way.
Well, let's talk about that here in a little bit. I want to sort of lead up to this because I can't imagine, you know, like I said, reading your book, I myself was crying. I can't imagine being the fellow in your boots actually doing that. But you say that you're starting to realize that sometimes we do more harm by suppressing our emotions as opposed to allowing ourselves to actually feel them, you know, and putting it away and then moving on. I don't know if it was after this unscheduled drive to Phoenix or you started thinking about, you found yourself literally driving into and sitting in the parking lot of the mental health facility, but you could not quite ever get up the courage to go in. In your book, in the chapter actually called And Then I Cried, let me just read a quote here. I was crying for every man and woman and child I'd laid to rest. That day I realized I finally surrendered and recognized I could no longer walk this path alone. You finally walked through that door of the mental health facility and you told the guy behind the front desk, it took me over a year to get the courage to walk through that door. If I can't be seen today, I'll never walk through that door again. You know, share with our listeners now that point you got to where something finally broke and you said, look, I need to get some help.
Well, I mean, the dissociations were getting bad. They were happening more and more frequently. My wife was reporting that I was screaming very loudly in my sleep, that she would catch me up, you know, checking all the perimeter of the house. And she said, you know, she kind of gave me an ultimatum. She said, you either get help, or I'm going to go to your commander. My wife was active duty as well, so she had that access. So I would, you know, to appease her at first, I would go sit in the mental health clinic parking lot and I'd eat my lunch. And I told her, well, I tried today and that was good enough for her at the time. And, it took, you know, 6 months to a year until I finally got the courage to walk through that door. And I did it with a tear in my eye, you know, and I walked up and there was a Sarman first class sitting at the counter and he was very professional, I remember. And he looked the part and he goes, well, sir, I got an appointment in 2 weeks. And I looked at him dead in the eye, and I was an E6 at the time, a tech sergeant, and I said, Airman, if I don't get an appointment today, you'll never see me again. And I don't know if he took that to heart, really, and he said, sir, right this way. and he, mm-hmm. he ushered me back to a therapist's office, and they got me in immediately, and that started my road to recovery.
Now, Justin, it's important for our listeners to realize and to hear the fact that, as I mentioned before, you never went outside the wire. So often, you know, you were deployed, but so often people think about PTSD as in relation to IEDs or bombs or seeing a buddy get shot. You never experienced any of that, and yet you had this huge burden that was weighing on you. And I would guess there's others, whether they be first responders or doctors or other folks who just, these things do impact the brain and the soul and the mind and the spirit. Share with us a little bit about how, I mean, did you doubt yourself? Like, I don't deserve to have PTSD?
Exactly. I did. And those are the words I used exactly. When I was going through therapy myself, I'm sitting in group therapy with all these operators. Well, I call them operators, you know, like pararescue men, defenders, which are, you know, security forces, all these men and women that I revered so highly because of the, you know, the door kickers, the guys that went over there and fought the war. I didn't feel like I deserved to breathe their same air because here I am just doing my job. You know, I'm a glorified cook, you know, in quotes and air quotes. And here I am just doing my job. And I said it once in therapy, you know, I don't deserve to have PTSD. And this, I'll never forget it. This, PJ, I won't mention his name, but he kind of saved my life. I'm a big guy. I'm 6'3", 250 pounds. And he jumped out of his chair and grabbed me by my collar and threw me against the wall, and he goes, I wouldn't trade places with you in a million years. Mm. We're going to get better together. And that really kind of, to this day, was kind of my walls crumbling down and realizing I couldn't do it on my own.
Well, you know, Justin, it's interesting. I was just thinking about this. Their motto, the motto of the PJs, the pararescue, is these things we do so that others may live. He was just fulfilling his motto in a little bit of a different scenario there.
He was. He's an amazing man. He struggled with his own recovery, and I don't talk to him as much as I'd like to anymore, but definitely he's doing well. He's starting to do well. So I'm glad to hear that. And I don't think he really understands the impact he had on my life.
Mm. Well, I tell you what, so you choose to get some help. You're getting better. And now you've really dedicated your life to making sure that other folks get some help. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about that. I want to talk about this amazing four-footed companion, wingman that you had, if you will, that was part of your recovery. Stick around, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back with the author of And Then I Cried, Stories of a Mortuary NCO, Justin Jordan.
My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Justin Jordan. Justin came to us via Bravo 748. It's just a military and combat speakers bureau. They've got great folks. I encourage you to check out their website, bravo748.com. See if there's find someone you might want to bring in to speak to your organization or your company. Justin also wrote a very powerful book called And Then I Cried, Stories of a Mortuary NCO. Justin, like I said, I enjoyed the book. I hated the book all at the same time, if you take that with the way it's meant. But you also achieved a first in your military career. You were the first member of the armed services, not just the Air Force, but I think all the branches, to be approved to serve with the aid of a service dog. How did that – well, interesting story about how that came about. I believe this was in New Mexico.
Yes, sir. Well, I had through therapy that we just talked about, you know, going into there, a therapist recommended that I should, you know, I've been in this place for a long time in Davis-Monthan, and I should probably start looking for another assignment because there were so many triggers there. Now, he didn't really, avoidance is not normally one of the things they do in therapy. However, he felt like that might be beneficial for me. So I did. I got an assignment to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I was working there with the Air Force IG, and I thought I was cured. I didn't know enough about PTSD until, you know, right outside of my office building, there was a mass shooting, because we were close to the front gate, or the side gate, the U-Bank gate, actually. And I could see all the coroner vans coming up to this building where this mass shooting had happened, and everything kind of spilled back. And, you know, I didn't know what to do, but I'd known I'd gotten help before, so I went over to the mental health clinic and, you know, discussed my concerns with psychotropic drugs. I didn't want any drugs for this because I'd seen so many overdoses. And the discussion of a service dog came up. This was in 2010, you know, before, you know, we see service dogs with veterans all the time now. And there had been some veterans doing it, but nobody in the active force. And I went to my commander, and he had just read an article on it, and he said, let's do it. And he got it approved up all the way to chief staff level. And in August of 2010, I brought Dallas, Staff Sergeant Dallas Jordan, to work, an English Bulldog. And she became quickly way more popular than I was. the colonels and everybody that I worked with would stop by my cubicle on the daily, as their daily, to say hello to Dallas. And I'm like, I'm sitting right here. And they're like, whatever. But she kind of became a spokesman. You know, it kind of pushed me into the advocacy role, because now everybody wants to know, what's the dog do for you? Because here I am proclaiming to the world I have PTSD because I have this dog that helps me. And how she helped me specifically is she would alert on my attacks. When I would have those dissociative moments, she was trained to lick my neck at my exit so I wouldn't end up, you know, away from home. I would get home on time and my wife wouldn't have to worry about where I'm at. Mm-hmm. When I'd be in a restaurant, she could feel, she could, you know, smell the chemicals that were brewing in my brain, I guess. She would kind of, you know, tug at my leg or growl at me. And nothing loud or obnoxious. And I could go outside and put my hands on her, and that would help alleviate that. But where she helped me the most, I developed, you talked about earlier in the interview, smells being so powerful to memories. I had olfactory hallucinations where I would smell bodies when I had my uniform on, because I would suppress so much. When I put my hands on her, those went away. She's another one that really kind of saved my life in this recovery process. It's been a very, very long process, and I'll admit to you that it's not over yet. But I said early on, I made a promise to that guy we talked about earlier, that PJ, that I wouldn't let it beat me, and I live that promise every day.
Well, and I want to share for our listeners out there, if you know of someone who could use some help, this this organization we're talking about here with the dog is called Paws and Stripes. You can find them at pawsandstripes.org. You know, Justin, it's interesting you mentioned it's a daily struggle. Your last year on duty, you were asked to work from home.
Yeah,
okay. I wanted the feeling of being thrown away like that.
Yeah, it's something that I really initially felt like I was very supported, and I was. I had great leadership. But when I had some situations with the dog, like in a restaurant, I was thrown out of a restaurant for having my dog. Cops were calling me. Now my dog became my anxiety, so I was struggling again with PTSD and how to deal with it. Now I didn't feel like my dog, she became the anxiety. So I went to inpatient treatment in Salt Lake City and left her behind. And when I came back, I had all new leadership, and they didn't really know how to deal with PTSD as well. And that started my medical retirement process the last year. And I was just asked, why don't you just work from home? Looking back, you know, I didn't really fight it. It wasn't, you know, they just didn't. I don't blame them. I think it was just they didn't know how to deal with it or how to, you know, work with the mental health team to care for me properly. So they just were trying to be, it came from a helpful place. I would never bash anyone in my brothers and sisters in blue, because all they were trying to do was help me. But I did feel thrown away at the time. That sentiment is echoed among a lot of military warriors that are going through the medical board process. Because the mission goes on, and they have to go on, and to stop and have to deal. We've got to get better at how we treat mental illness in the military. We're getting there. But, you know, it's just about conversations that we're having like this that get the awareness, so we can, you know, we can definitely get them the help they need without throwing them away or making them feel thrown away, because that just adds to the suicide epidemic.
Yeah, Justin, do you continue to advocate to this day for others that are going through what you're going through, do you think that the military is getting better about recognizing the needs? Because I would guess part of the reluctance to go in and visit a professional in the first place is that's a career ender. If I do this, I'm out.
It is. I think it's getting better. I had the opportunity to work for the Air Force Wounded Warrior Program about a year ago. I was working there for 2 years, and I helped them start the Ambassador Program, where we would take wounded warriors and teach them how to share their story. And then I kind of acted as their agent, and I put them in front of commander's courses, and I'd put them in front of general officers, the decision makers, and they would share their stories and how they felt thrown away, whether it be cancer, military sexual trauma, combat injuries, PTSD from job-related incidents. It didn't matter. If they had a compelling story, we wanted these commanders and these decision makers and the base populace to understand, because when you share your story, it no longer has power on you. And it does have power on those hearing it, and change can be made. So I've seen the institution of, and in the Air Force, the Invisible Wounds Initiative led by a two-star general. So we're making progress. It's a slow, but we're making it.
Justin, we've got just about 3 minutes left. I heard you say that helping others can be addicting. You continue to do that. Tell us about Warrior's Heart real quick.
Sure. I work now as the outreach coordinator for Warrior's Heart. It's a drug and alcohol treatment center in Bandera, Texas, my home, where I live now. And it is the only one in the country that focuses specifically on co-occurring disorders for military, law enforcement, first responders. So if they're dealing with an addiction issue as well as a PTSD or military sexual trauma or whatever, a lot of these first responders and militaries don't feel like the traditional ways of help them, because their stories, they can't possibly understand what they go through. Well, this is set up on a 543-acre ranch, and it's only military, first responders, and law enforcement. So they come in feeling like they're heard, and we're doing a lot of great things for our country's heroes. And it's humbling to be able to work in a place like this and really affect change.
Justin, for those listeners out there who might be going through this themselves or have got a family member, you know, PTSD affects the entire family, not just the warrior or the first responder, the sheepdog. What do you want to leave them with?
That, you know, it's okay to get help yourself. That, you know, if, you know, my wife was such a rock in my recovery. And you know, that it's okay to ask for help. And there's no playbook on how to deal with this. You know, anger a lot of times, this isn't the same person that I married, this, that, and the other. Understand they're going through a psychological issue and they may not have control over it. But there's nothing you can do solely by yourself to help them. You have to get professional help. So please seek that professional help for yourself so that you can help them. That's what I'd leave them with.
Well, I was hoping you'd be a little more long-winded. We've got a minute left.
Well, you know,
those are good. How is your wife doing, by the way, Justin?
She's doing great. She, you know, she was medically retired as well, mm-hmm. And you know, she, like I said, she was there with me the whole time. We every day I get to, you know, she stuck with me. She's still with me. I'm the luckiest man in the world. I really am, because a lot of our men and women that struggle like I did don't have that luxury of having someone that sticks by them no matter what. You know, she took our vows very seriously, and I'm happy to announce that in July that we will be married almost 19. We'll be married 19 years, and very proud fact of mine. And our kids are now adults, and we get to every Sunday, like before we talked when we had a little conversation. Every Sunday we get together and discuss our wins for the week. And then things that we need to work on as a family. That's my son, my daughter, his fiance, and my wife. We all get together and do that as a family tradition. It really helps.
Well, Justin, thank you so much for your courage to put your experiences and your thoughts down on paper. Ladies and gentlemen, the book is And Then I Cried, Stories of a Mortuary NCO. You can find this broadcast and other podcasts at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Over 150 stories, not all like Justin's, but pretty good stories out there. Like us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio. Also on Twitter, at Warrior Radio TUC. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, this has been your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. All policies and procedures are to remain in place. Thank you very much.